A podcast of the cinema.
My name is Dave White. Who are you?
I thought there was going to be more to it than that. I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
We're film critics.
Yes.
You're film critic. You film critic with The Wrap and What the Flick.
Correct.
I film critic with The Wrap too, but in a different way.
Every so often.
You're kind of a boss at The Wrap.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like a hired gun.
Sure.
Yeah.
If that's how you...
I'm a sharpshooter, though.
If that's how you want to delineate it, fine.
Like, I write like 2 reviews a month for The Wrap.
Yeah, I guess so.
Sometimes 3 if last minute you come to me and say, hey, take this. Like you just did last week.
Right.
With Bad Santa 2.
Yes.
Which we are not reviewing today because it's not opened yet.
Nope, we'll get
We're
to
gonna
that.
We're going to do it next time.
Or soon-ish.
Next time, there, probably. Yeah,
but there might be another show between now and next time.
There will be another show between now and next time.
Right.
You're getting... you know why? It's Thanksgiving soon, and you're going to be thankful for us for the extra episode we're going to give you. Because we've got extra movies.
Yes.
And a front ton of letters that we got to get through.
So there'll be some catchy upsies going on.
So between now and actual next week, sometime between now, like it's Sunday now, mm-hmm. Thursday's Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. probably Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just in time for you to listen to us on your headphones while you're traveling somewhere.
Yeah, or avoiding your family.
Which you know you want to do.
Just wear your earbuds at Thanksgiving dinner and not participate in the conversations that you know will start a fight.
So what about this podcast? What did we say? Did we say it was a podcast of the cinema?
We said that.
And we introduced ourselves.
We did.
And we told them what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're married.
That too.
If you're new, that's a thing.
Yeah.
We're married to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's talk about some movies.
Yeah, there's a lot this week.
Well,
okay.
There is, but we haven't seen everything.
You haven't seen everything.
Right. We haven't seen everything. We is a pronoun, including you.
Right.
And me.
So just to let you know, we will be getting to L and the Edge of 17.
L is the new Paul Verhoeven film starring Isabelle Huppert.
Yes.
And it's in French.
It is in French.
Yeah, okay.
And The Edge of 17.
Which is in English.
Yes.
And
stars Hailee Steinfeld.
But I got to go. You've seen Edge of 17.
I've seen both of these movies.
I got to go buy me a ticket like tomorrow morning or Tuesday morning. So I can look at it.
So we'll talk about those. But today we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. There's a lot of films opening. And you've already seen the title of this episode, so you know what we're talking about.
Fantastic Beasts.
Fantastic Beasts,
which is what I am.
We'll just dive right into that.
I think I might actually be more of a Fantastic Beasts. I might be more of a Fantastic Beast than the ones I actually saw in the film.
Well, you are not a nocturnal animal, this much we know.
We'll get to that in a minute.
I know.
But what are you doing?
I'm just turning my
You're turning your headphones down. Yes. Okay. Thought you were doing something technical that I needed to know about.
No.
All right. Because I saw in this Fantastic Beast movie a thing that looked like an albino hedgehog with a thing on its back. I didn't quite figure out what it was. Then there was the platypussy thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a platypus. Like
shiny things.
Shoplifted.
There's the horny rhinoceros with the with the liquid boils.
He was cool. Then the big bird.
The big bird, the buggy beetle-y thing.
Oh yeah, and then the thing that flies.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a grasshopper that flies.
Mm-hmm.
couldn't ever really quite figure out what the Fantastic Beasts were.
Yeah, that's...
And I just kept thinking, compared to me, who is more fantastic? Me or that Fantastic Beast? And I would think to myself, you, Dave White, you are the Fantastic Beast in this equation. Not that thing. First of all, it's not even real.
Well, no.
It's not even a real thing. It's a digital cartoon of a thing. I'm flesh and blood.
Yeah, I kind of found this to be a digital cartoon of a movie.
You're not going to go with me on this journey, are you? Oh. You're just going to start talking about the movie.
Sorry.
You're not going to yes and me about what a fantastic beast I am. Baby, it's okay.
Baby, you're the...
I'm just making you some dinner right now,
You're the fantasticest beast. I assure you of that.
That's correct. Start telling people what happens in this movie.
Oh, brother. Okay. Eddie Redmayne.
It's from J.K. Rowling.
It's J.K. Rowling's first screenplay.
And it's set in... I was very confused. As you know, listeners who have listened many times before...
You exist in a bubble.
I like to keep myself in a bubble. It is a bubble that protects my enthusiasm for my job. That enthusiasm can be worn down to a raw, sad little nub by too much pre-release information,
hype,
hyperactive marketing, and any other kind of chatter. Film Twitter is particularly annoying in this regard, and I tend to unfollow people who do too much talky-talk about pre-release stuff. Exception? William Bibbiani, who makes me laugh. Also, he's my heterosexual husband. Even though he just got married heterosexually to a lady.
Yes. Yes, he did.
Yeah. He talks about pre-release things quite a bit. But it's fine, because when he does it, I can just goof on him.
My favorite thing is that after a big movie opens...
Yeah.
Matt Singer from Screen Crush...
Yes.
...will go back and find 25... things that were totally false that people were saying were going to happen in this movie,
and that's amusing.
Yes,
but I don't read.
I would never have seen those things beforehand.
I got to avoid all of those 25 things.
Yeah,
by my bubble, with my little bubble.
I'm not as bubbly as you are, but I do shun that stuff whenever I can.
I didn't see a trailer for this film. All I knew was that it was kind of something about Harry Potter. That was everything I knew. And on the day of the screening, I said to you, is Harry Potter in this movie? And you said no. And I said, why do I think it's about Harry Potter? And you said, because it exists in the wizarding world of Harry Potter.
Yes.
And I said, what's going to happen? And you said, just look at the poster. Everybody's got wands and shh. Which means... that this movie's about wizards.
Yes.
And it's set, like, in the 1920s.
Correct.
70 years before Harry Potter.
Yes.
Therefore, the parameters of Harry Potterishness are already...
somewhat set in stone.
Imposed on this world.
We got a very interesting letter about this, but we're going to... We're going to hold it until... more of you have seen the movie, so yeah. It doesn't spoil anything.
It's
the prequel dilemma where we know what it's building toward,
right?
And so that limits the number of paths it can take.
So I get there and I watch the whole film and I understand now that it has nothing to do with Harry Potter at all. They do talk about Hogwarts.
They talk about Hogwarts.
And they do talk about muggles, even though it's set in America and they have a different word for muggles. They call them non-madge.
No-madge.
No-madge.
Yeah.
Un-madge.
Muggles better. And
all right, so you start again. Tell me
what it's
about.
And there's some guy who is discussed much in the film who's this, like... bad wizard doing bad things, who it turns out is...
His name is Grindel something.
I'm so not versed in all this stuff.
Bumbershoot.
Yes, Bumbershoot, who it turns out is Rowling later said was the boyfriend of Dumbledore. So, you know, there's that.
Oh. So he... When?
I don't know.
Is it going to be in one of the movies?
I don't know if it's a thing that happens at this point.
Are there going to be wizard makeouts?
I don't know if it happened before this movie takes place, but that's the deal. So,
who's going to be young Dumbledore?
I don't know.
Hmm.
But, you know, we got four more of these movies to go, so, you know.
I demand gay wizard makeouts.
That would be nice.
That's what I demand.
We'll see what we get. In any event, these movies do have to play in China, after all.
I don't care about them.
They do. Warner Brothers cares. Warner Brothers cares a lot.
They can snip that part out for China.
I suppose.
Homophobes.
It'll be like the Nicholas Brothers and the Pirate. They'll just take it out for certain audiences. Okay, so it's about Newt Scamander, who wrote a textbook that is widely used by Harry and his Hogwarts pals, yes, called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Yes, yes.
And so in this story...
Page one, Dave White, California.
In this story, Scamander, who's played by Eddie Redmayne, who Louis Vertel had the best description of once, that he was like the walking manifestation of a lady's blush or something. I can't remember now. I got to find it. Anyway, he travels to New York with an enchanted suitcase that is loaded with Fantastic Beasts. He is a magizoologist or something. Anyway, his presence in New York rather quickly calls attention to itself. And he is discovered by an agent of the Magical Congress of the United States of America, or MACUSA, played by Catherine Waterston.
Yes.
And
From Inherent Vice.
And she,
an incredible film.
She is investigating this like fundamentalist religious sect called the Second Salemers, run by Samantha Morton, who are trying to like shut down witchcraft and wizardry in America.
She's Lady Fred Phelps, basically.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's like, but meanwhile, there's this whole magical bureaucracy that's run by Carmen Ejogo and Colin Farrell.
Yes.
And they're trying to figure out like what these mysterious
who's things. Causing the destruction and what to do about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this guy who's in a bank, who's trying to get a loan to open a bakery, played by Dan Fogler, who has a suitcase that's exactly like Newt Scamander's.
So it's What's Up, Doc?
Exactly. They have have a What's Up, Doc moment where they swap suitcases and kookiness ensues. Catherine Waterston has a sister named Queenie who can read minds and is kind of a flapper. And things and stuff and loud and whatever. The baker and the mind reader were the most interesting characters.
Dan Fogler and Queenie.
Yes.
Who plays Queenie?
I was hoping you knew. One moment. Alison Sudol, Sudol, mainly known as a musician apparently, but she plays Kaya on Transparent. And I've watched Transparent and could not tell you for the life of me which one Kaya is. But, you know, I'm sure... she's great on that. Anyway, she and Dan Fogler have a lovely little chemistry going on here, and they were the only thing in this movie that I was remotely interested in. I didn't care about Newt Scamander. I didn't care about his beasts. I didn't care about Catherine Waterston, who is an interesting actress, but given nothing to do here but this dishwater kind of functionary role. And this movie winds up being all sort of superhero-y. It's like big, awful beast destroys a lot of New York City. Can they fix it? You know, and then, like, there's this whole argument about whether the wizards should remain hidden or whether they should, you know, take over. And I was like, oh, great, it's an X-Men movie. We needed more of those.
Right.
The movie looks artificial. I never felt like these people were really walking around 1920s New York. There's something about the way it's lit or the way that the effects work. It just all felt kind of fakey to me.
The production design is, in fact, a little hermetically sealed.
Yeah.
Which did not bother me.
Well, everything is either real shiny or real Dickensian.
Yeah. The effects are the shiny part. Mm-hmm. The rest of the stuff is the Dickensian part. I did not mind the look. I liked the drab, gray, black darkness. And I felt comfortable in the idea that this was existing, that this existed in a contained environment. It reminded me of watching an old movie on TCM where everything is clearly inside a soundstage.
No, I know what you're saying. And there are certain movies where that's fine.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The Harry Potter movies conditioned me to buy this stuff in a recognizable world.
I understand.
And obviously those had the benefit of not having to be period pieces. They could be contemporary. But in a contemporary world, I still bought all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so... And this movie, it's not even just that I didn't buy into the period world. Like, it's not presented as excitingly as it was in the Potter films. Like, we talked about this one with the flick. You've got, you know, platform 9 3/4.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
That felt like a tangible, real thing.
Yeah.
And it was cool, and it was interesting, and you understood how it worked.
Right.
The magical Congress of the United States is hidden in the Woolworth Building.
Yes.
And you get into it by walking into the door that's next to the revolving doors.
Yes.
But there's no, like, moment where when they go through that door, they're suddenly in this other place. It just feels like they walked into a door and there's this thing. You know, just stuff like that. And I don't know, I wasn't invested
in
anything.
You did not engage.
I didn't engage. I wasn't invested in the characters or the world they inhabited or the conflicts they faced. And the idea that there's four more of these, I'm like, it felt like J.K. Rowling writing her own fan fiction. It was like somebody, it was like she had this interesting thing and it was cool and it was done and it was, you know, it was finished. And now she's like, what corner can I dig back into? Okay, here's a book I referenced in these series. What's the story of that?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like,
and I think that's a fine place to begin.
It's not an inherently bad idea, but what she's done with it isn't very interesting, I don't think.
I think that the relevancy of this film to now is that she is a very socially progressive writer.
Yeah.
And so there are themes of destruction caused by an unknowable. And of course that is parallel to terrorism.
Obviously, so, the dangers of repression come up a lot.
And then there's the idea of, you know, control and repression and things like that. So I like where she wants to go.
Yeah,
I like how it looks, and I honestly enjoyed myself more than you did.
Yes, you did.
I walked away from this thinking it's a pretty good kind of stumbling first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to be told more. Oh, look, hang on. My magical timer says it's time to take the stuff out of the oven. Pause, please, while I do these things.
Well, you can listen to me talk while you do that thing.
We had to pause for just a moment because
magic beans.
They are kind of magical. I mean, I'm smelling a fairly magical thing.
They smell tasty.
From the kitchen. Here, let's digress for a little moment. I was given a very large bag of lima beans, dried ones,
mm-hmm.
from a friend who in turn got them from a world-renowned chef.
Yes.
And so I...
world-renowned chef did not pass any recipes along.
No. Here's a bag of beans.
Lima beans, we should specify.
And and I didn't know what to do with them because I realized something today. I'm 52 years old. And I don't think I've ever eaten lima beans before.
You know, years ago, when Brussels sprouts made it back into the gourmet thing, I said, the lima bean revolution is next.
You did not say that.
I did say that.
To whom? Who was listening to you
I'm
say
sure
that?
I tweeted it or something. Because
did you?
It was just one of those things where it was like the Brussels sprout was such the universally hated vegetable, and now suddenly it had become chic. And I was like, all right, lima bean is going to have its turn. You know, we discovered kale. Everything is possible.
I got the bag of lima beans, and I looked at the bag of lima beans for a few months thinking, what the hell am I supposed to do with this? Because I don't think I've ever cooked them, and I don't think I've ever eaten them because... Do you want to eat lima beans? Is that like high on your list of stuff ever that you want to eat? Like, lima beans.
Bring it on.
And it wound up in a photo that I tweeted about something else. The bag is in the background. Mm-hmm. And our friend Elise said, what you going to do with those lima beans? I said, I don't know.
Something, trade them for a cow.
I keep thinking, like, what am I supposed to do with them? I'm looking up recipes. None of them seem all that appealing to me. And she passed a recipe along to me, which, and she swears it's delicious. And it smells pretty good.
Right?
So in about 25 more minutes, that alarm's going to go off again, and we're going to pause the recording again so I can go do the next step.
Of bean things.
Of lima bean preparation.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, back to the movie.
So, okay, I would like to think that maybe this movie gets all the boring world-building stuff out of the way.
Yeah.
And now we can have stories and characters.
Well, it's a bit of an origin story, although it's an origin story in a world that you've already been introduced to.
Yeah, and I didn't find the beasts themselves all that fascinating.
They're not
great. Some of them are kind of cute, but like
The platypus. I was into
the platypus. Was okay, yeah. But mostly, like, I didn't find them interesting. Didn't think they added much to the story, and didn't care about Newt Scamander or about Catherine Waterston's character at all.
I'm kind of having to dance around the thoughts I really have about this film. Not in terms of its quality, but in terms
of
what it's about. Because the stuff that happens, this is going to have to be another film we discuss later.
Yeah.
And didn't we get a message from someone this week who was like, you didn't go back to talk about this, and you didn't go back to talk about this, and you didn't go back to talk about this, and here's where you said you would. And I thought, I wish people weren't paying so much attention to what
I
we
know.
Say, because we're
welchers.
We routinely do not go back to the things we say we want to go back to. But I guess we're going to have to
one. This is the free podcast. You want to make demands, you want to make us snap too, you go talk to us about the podcast that you pay for. This is the free one.
But if we say we're going to do something, we should eventually get around to doing
it. Yes,
Maybe we do like a 2016 spoilers episode.
Maybe.
Where we talk about the endings and we talk about our thoughts now about stuff we saw 7-8 months ago.
That's a thought.
That's not a bad idea.
That's not a bad idea at all.
Like after Christmas when things are slow and quiet and we don't have to do anything except sit around in our pajamas.
Okay.
Yeah. Although that's kind of what we've done today.
I was going to say. It's because it rained today.
It's cold and rainy in Los Angeles today, and that's the perfect... First of all, it's the perfect weather to spend all afternoon in the kitchen making a lima bean recipe that takes 3 hours.
Lima beans need a lot of work.
Yeah.
You can't just toss them around higgledy-piggledy.
So it's all, I mean, you're literally sitting at the kitchen table.
Yes.
With your fuzzy slippers and your pajama bottoms and your massive for opening ceremony sweatshirt.
And that's right.
Yeah.
I am comfy, comfy, cozy. But yeah, I wanted to like Fantastic Beasts. I am a Potter fan. I read the books. I like the movies. But I just found this charmless.
I think it's fine. It's just fine.
All right.
I'm not even going to say it's pretty good. Earl, a few days ago, I was on Overnight America with John Grayson, this syndicated radio show that I'm on every week, and you occasionally are when I'm out of pocket or whatever. Right. No matter where you live, it's on at like 1 o'clock in the morning. So
hence the name Overnight America.
Obviously, I record these segments in the afternoon with him the day before. But at the time, I said, you know, it's pretty good. But I think I may
downgrade that to good.
Dial that back to it's fine.
Okay.
It's not amazing. It's not wondrous. And that is a thing about magical stuff that it would be nice if I felt that sense of wonder.
Yeah.
Not as captivating as the Potter films.
Nope.
Partially because it's about adults, not kids.
That was part of it, too.
And those adults, they've already... you don't get to watch them learn their magic. There's no surprise. And so they are just like, hey, I'm a wizard, zap.
Also, what's the deal with Colin Farrell and Ezra Miller in this movie?
What about it?
It's weirdly touchy between the two of them.
They have some sort of unexplained relationship that we don't know about.
All right. Yeah. It'd be interesting if that emerges in the sequels, because it was so like, what's going on with them?
Yeah. It felt like stuff was edited out.
Or something. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get to that later.
Didn't hate it.
I didn't hate it, but I was very...
You've kind of been hating it a lot over the past few days.
Okay.
I've been listening to you talk about things you really dislike about it.
All right. If I had to tomato meter it, I would rotten it.
Okay.
But that's not to say there weren't things in it that I liked, specifically those two actors and their relationship.
Why is it a green splat?
And not a juicy...
Why is it not a juicy red tomato? Director X... Director X, thank you for that. We will always thank Director X
for green splat and juicy red tomato. Okay. We also both saw Nocturnal Animals.
Speaking of Fantastic Beasts.
Yes. So Tom Ford's sophomore effort.
I'm going to tell you what happens. Amy Adams is a gallerist in Los Angeles. But she does not represent the emerging artists of the world, the up-and-comers. She lives in such a fancy place that she's having a metallic Jeff Koons balloon dog installed in her backyard. That means she has millions of dollars to spend on a piece of art.
That she's willing to be exposed to the elements.
Well, that's okay, because those things... are often frequently outside.
Okay.
Yeah. And
I just worry about sun fading, you know.
I think when you buy a piece by Jeff Koons like that and it costs you millions of dollars, there's some kind of maintenance involved that only Jeff Koons knows about.
You get the warranty.
She is essentially Lady Gagosian. All right. She lives in a sleek...
She's a Gagosian.
Yeah. She lives in a sleek, beautiful, modern home, which is always the symbol of soullessness in films like this.
Go watch Los Angeles Plays Itself for more discussion of that.
She is married to Armie Hammer.
Mm-hmm. Her second husband.
He is her second husband. And he is... Keir Delay. He is Alain Delon in Purple Noon.
Right.
He is...
soulless male beauty.
He is trophy husband who doesn't speak much, never smiles, doesn't do much of above a whisper.
Right.
The makeup department deserves some kind of award for what they did to him. The makeup and the lighting on Armie Hammer in this film is...
beautiful object.
Yeah. He gleams like a prize, and
he's an Oscar.
He's all smooth surfaces and empty something inside. So I really appreciated that. Anyway, she gets a manuscript in the mail, a novel called Nocturnal Animals, written by her ex-husband, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Right.
Who she has been apart from for 19 years.
Yes.
And although I don't think that Jake Gyllenhaal or Amy Adams are old enough to have been divorced 19 years from someone. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know how old either one of them is.
They get together like in college.
Okay. So I guess that makes them 37 each. That was
a sticking point.
A little sticking point for me, but whatever. It doesn't matter. They're playing older.
Okay.
And she begins to read the novel. Now, it's not just that she's a gallerist and extremely rich. and surrounded by art that the film references thematically in the course of the movie, she's powerfully unhappy. Armie Hammer is a cold, distant husband.
And unfaithful.
And unfaithful.
She gave
does
up
not
on,
love him.
She gave up on her own ambitions.
She was originally going to be an artist, and she instead chose to get an MFA in art history so that she could enter the world of commerce, basically.
Whereas Jake Gyllenhaal always...
stuck to his guns and stayed a novelist.
Exactly.
And poor. Like, he's a teacher at a school.
He's an academic.
And he wrote a novel. So the film shifts back and forth between Amy Adams reading a book and the contents of that book.
With occasional flashbacks to her life with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes. The contents of that book... Do I tell you what the contents of that book are?
We can say that it's a somewhat disturbing...
It's a very disturbing...
revenge novel.
Yeah.
And the as Amy Adams imagines it in her mind, the protagonist of the book
I'm giving you a look right now.
I don't think this is a spoiler.
It's not a spoiler, but I'm giving you a look right now because I don't want you to say too much. Okay.
The protagonist of the book, she imagines, is Jake Gyllenhaal.
She imagines Jake Gyllenhaal as the main character in the book. And she imagines... This blew my mind.
This is hilarious.
Made me so happy. She imagines Isla Fisher...
as his wife.
As his wife.
Because Isla Fisher and Amy Adams look more alike than anybody since Lily Tomlin and John Travolta.
Yeah. And so...
And then within the book...
Terrible things happen.
Yes. Okay. The book that she's reading goes to very dark places involving a bad hombre played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, who has never been better.
Yeah, well, I disagree with you.
Really?
I think he is kind of a wild-eyed overactor.
I thought he was really good in this. And then Michael Shannon as the sheriff.
His pal, did you recognize his buddy?
Maybe not. Who is it?
Carl Glusman.
Remind me.
Do you remember where you've seen him? Do you remember where you've seen every square inch of his body?
Oh, from Love,
right? He was in Love.
Yes, sorry. I saw this movie at...
Yeah.
I saw this movie at the Venice Film Festival, so it's been a while.
Gaspar Noé's Love, the film with actual, straight-up, real sex.
Yes.
That young Carl Glusman was not afraid to have
on
screen.
He was in something else recently, right? We reviewed something.
He's been
in
a lot of stuff. He's all over the place.
He was in something this summer that we reviewed.
You're going to eventually learn his face and name because he is
a
rising figure in the world. He was in Neon Demon.
Neon Demon, that was it, yes.
He was in Stonewall. he is in the new miniseries adaptation of Gypsy that's coming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So... but yeah, he's...
Yeah, I did recognize him at the time. I just had forgotten about him.
So I thought he was good.
Michael Shannon is really good.
Michael Shannon's the best in this movie. Michael Shannon... Furthermore, I mean...
He's always good.
Michael Shannon is always the guy you want to look at the most in a movie because he's...
Unpredictable.
He's... Every moment, you don't know what he's going to do or say or look like from minute to minute.
Like, he takes that... Christopher Walken thing of taking the punctuation out of the screenplay and sort of takes it to the next level where he just takes the punctuation out of everything.
Yeah. I could not admire or adore him more than I do. he plays a sheriff.
Yeah.
Who is a character in the novel.
Right.
Now, I believe this film to be a beautiful object, very much like Armie Hammer. I don't know if I feel like or if I think that a story has been sufficiently told.
I think it has. I think that... And obviously, I think it's one of the movies that I immediately thought, I need to see this again. But I think that he's... And it's based on a novel.
Yes.
I feel that this movie is telling us a story wherein the two stories feed into each other.
That is true.
And what I think that it does really interestingly, and I think that probably this is part of what drew Tom Ford to the material,
yes,
is that the Amy Adams is a gallerist in an awesome boxy house with a Jeff Koons in the backyard,
yeah,
is the movie that you're expecting Tom Ford to make.
Yes.
And then the gritty Texas awful things happen story,
yes,
is not the movie that you expect Tom Ford to,
correct,
make. And he makes it really well. He makes both of them really well.
That story?
Yeah.
The novel that we're being shown?
Uh-huh.
That movie, if that were the whole movie,
mm-hmm,
I'd have been like, whoa, Tom Ford.
Yeah.
I understand that the two stories feed into each other.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the art angle of the film, mm-hmm, is used really knowingly and also a little thuddingly.
Well, you have to remember, most audiences are not going to know as much about contemporary art as you do. And so what might be crushingly obvious to you would either fly over my head or be something that I maybe get out of the corner of my eye.
There are works in the film by not just Jeff Koons, but Damien Hirst, Christopher Wool, John Curran, Sterling Ruby, and many others.
Yes, most of who I... And after I'm, Damien Hirst, you lost me on that list.
I'm... And I can feel the movie stopping to point out the art,
mm-hmm,
and telling you, look at that piece of art because it's thematically important to the thing that's going on around you. Like, there's a scene where Jenna Malone and Amy Adams stand in front of a Christopher Wool painting. And if it's not Christopher Wool, it's an incredible simulation of Christopher Wool. And I didn't need it. I didn't need that. I'm looking at the painting thinking, all right, sure, yeah, I get it. I get what you're doing. But
he didn't also, I don't think he randomly chose that she would work in the art world. I think that her choice to give up art, the creative practice of art, to become a merchant of art, obviously, is essential to the character. And so I think he's just sort of underscoring it by surrounding her with the stuff that would be in her trade, you
know? I did think about a Christopher Wool painting that I saw once in relation to this film. And it's one of the text paintings. And the one in the movie is a text painting as well. But this text painting says, sell the house, sell the car, sell the kids. And... I mean, if you had put that on the wall, it would have been equally as obvious to me. And so, I'm having trouble with this movie.
Okay.
I want it to be, it's gorgeous.
Yes.
He subscribes to every frame a painting. Like, there's no getting around his ability to envelop you in beauty, even if it's harsh. Ugly beauty. And I understand exactly what the film is about thematically.
Yes.
And why the stories fit together. I saw it this morning,
mm-hmm,
at 8 a.m. at, yep, the ArcLight. Thanks, Fantastic Beasts. Whenever a big giant movie opens, the screenings start crazy early in the morning, which is great for me because I'm up at 5. And so
if you're seeing some other movie,
it was me and these four other non-nocturnal animals in the screening this morning.
I saw it at 8 a.m. in Venice.
Because it was a film festival.
Yeah, it was a press screening.
My thoughts may change.
Okay.
I might even change my mind entirely. But right now, I feel a nagging dissatisfaction with this movie. It's beautiful to look at.
This is not a spoiler, but did the ending work for you?
Yes.
Okay, good.
But I figured it was coming.
Fair enough. What about Laura Linney's scene?
Oh, God. Laura Linney, you are the Michael Shannon of this film. You're the Lady Michael Shannon of this movie. Laura Linney
sweeps in for one scene.
How long did Beatrice Straight wind up on screen in Network for getting her supporting actress nomination?
Like 12 minutes or something.
Okay, how long is Laura Linney on camera? Five? Maybe
if that,
tops?
Yeah.
Nominate her. Nominate her. Nominate Shannon. Like, those two performances are what I will carry away.
Gotcha.
From this film.
Okay.
When Laura Linney shows up on camera, it took me three beats to remember, it's Laura Linney! God, I love her so much.
If we do a spoiler episode at the end of the year, we can circle back on this one and talk about the ending and talk about, see if your mind has changed at all.
Yeah,
I like this movie a lot. We also both saw Manchester by the Sea, which is a movie
I'm gonna talk about it.
That everyone loves.
Except you.
Except
me. And Christy.
And Christy.
Yeah, you and Christy, the both of you.
And a few people on Facebook have been like, oh, thank God, I thought it was just me.
Well, it's just you, little tiny group of people.
The vast minority, I understand.
It's a new film from Kenneth Lonergan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw You Can Count on Me.
Yes, me too.
You've
still never seen any version of Margaret, right?
Correct. And so, but we have the Blu-ray, so I'm going to sit down and watch it.
I know.
Probably over Christmas. I'm not going to have time until probably Christmas.
I keep meaning to make myself sit through the director's cut, but given how much I didn't like the theatrical cut, it's been a hard thing to force myself to do.
So, okay. This film stars Casey Affleck as a man who is basically a maintenance guy. And you don't know why that's his job. You find out a little later how that came to be. But he has a brother, played by Kyle Chandler.
Right.
And very early in the film, this is not a spoiler, Kyle Chandler dies. And in his will, leaves custody of his son, teenage son, about 16, to Casey Affleck. Casey Affleck does not want this responsibility. The kid has no, the kid has no opinion about it other than the kid doesn't want to be uprooted from his life.
He's
very solidly entrenched life in his town. Casey Affleck used to live in that town and has moved away to a new town to start a new life. You don't know why.
What you do know is,
and you eventually learn why,
he is a loner who lives in sort of a shabby, tiny run room apartment, and he gets into random fights in bars.
He gets drunk and brawls with folks. Now, that's really all I want to say about the plot, because the film slowly and very quietly, without a lot of histrionics, reveals the information to you, bit by bit, about how Casey Affleck became this person. It's a quiet film. It's about people who are navigating emotional space in some very familiar scenarios to anyone who's ever had a family or friends or community with whom there has been some brokenness of one sort or another. And you come to learn that there has been some brokenness. And I won't tell you what that is. But it is absolutely a kind of quotidian sort of thing. There's nothing extravagant about the plotting of this film. It is all absolutely believable and not incident that, makes their lives more interesting than anyone else's life. I feel like Lonergan has written and directed a very smart, beautifully controlled, intuitively acted story about people, everyday folks, making good and bad, and sometimes very bad choices in the process of trying to keep their lives together. And it covers a variety of experience. It's about grief. It's about remorse. It's about growing up. It's about compromise with family. It's about picking up pieces after everything's gone to hell. I love it. It is about a man who is ruined, who gets a second chance at maybe not being quite so ruined.
That's nice.
Tell me your wrong opinion about this film.
I just think this movie, to me, I did not buy into it at all.
Why?
Because the dialogue to me never sounded like what actual working class people talk like. It sounded like a New York playwright's conception of what working class people talk like.
Really?
Really. And I just found the whole thing so artificial and contrived, and the plot comes down to this thing where that when you drag a Will into it, and like, you know,
well, you know, wills do exist.
I know, but I'm not saying you can't have a will.
People write them, and they want their wishes obeyed.
I understand that, yeah. but it's such a contrived thing in a plot where, like, I'm going to fix your life by putting this thing in my will that's going to make you be different and have to change things up.
And you think that's what Kyle Chandler's character was aiming for?
Yes. Did you not?
I think that he was doing what he thought was best to take care of everyone in his life.
Nonetheless, it struck me as contrived. I didn't feel for these people at all.
It's the kind of thing that I would hope that before my deathbed came, that I would have the forethought to think about manipulating my family beyond the grave into something meaningful and beneficial for everyone.
Yeah, look, no, it didn't.
I love controlling things.
It didn't work for me, but people love this movie. And maybe if I had seen this movie at Sundance before hearing about how great it was for the rapturous
reception 10 months that it got.
Yeah, then
again, bubble.
Your bubble. No, I know.
That's my bubble.
I mean, like, but like, Bibbs has been talking about this movie all year. Like,
not
loves,
to me.
Loves, loves this movie.
Maybe he has been talking about it to me, and I've just not been listening.
It's certainly possible. God knows you don't listen to me half the time. But yeah, it just didn't do it for me, and so I'm just sort of I'm not even like making a thing about it at this point. I'm just sort of sitting back and like, all right, y'all liked it. It worked for you. Great. I can't sign on to this, but obviously I'm very much in the minority here, so I'm dead inside or whatever, but this is a dog whistle I can't hear.
I cannot recommend this highly enough.
I'm sure most of our listeners will love it.
It opens 4 screens nationwide this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be
there's
going to be an Oscar campaign.
This will
for this.
Totally be an Oscar season movie. It will open
so
wider.
You'll,
we'll get
you'll
out
get
to
it.
You,
you'll
so.
Get it somewhere near you, probably eventually, mm-hmm. unless you live like in the middle of nowhere. And then you'll still get it streaming in like 4 months.
Yeah.
So.
If you love it, I don't want to hear from you. You're not going to change my mind. If you don't love it, however, feel free to reach out to me for solidarity. I'm with you on this.
I really did think of this in the way that I think of a good book.
Okay.
You don't go to something like this to escape. You go to feel and think and engage with, you know, maybe your own unresolved stuff.
I would have loved to have had that experience. I was certainly not averse to it.
I found it incredibly moving and real and honest. I don't think there's a bit of fakiness, especially that your ideas about the dialogue. I don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing special about this dialogue.
I just didn't buy it.
I don't think it called attention to itself as dialogue at all.
The dialogue, the situations, the plotting, just the writing in general, it just left me cold. But whatever, sheeple. Go with that mass opinion. I'm sure the rave reviews on that are blurbed in the TV commercial from some, you know, Fox affiliate in Seattle.
Yeah.
No. Actual critics are all falling over themselves about this movie, so.
Oh, by the way, if you're one of those folks who's counting from the 25 minutes that I said before the timer goes off again for the lima beans, we already took care of that. You're not going to hear it.
That shoe's not
the magic of editing this podcast has taken care of that for you. You and I live in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And Los Angeles is one of five cities in the world that had a movie theater, not even multiple movie theaters, but a movie theater.
For one week,
showing Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk in director Ang Lee's
preferred
format, which is 120 frames per second, 4K digital 3D. 120 frames per second is nearly five times.
It is exactly five times.
Is it?
24 frames a second is the usual standard.
And 120 is...
five times 24.
Oh, you're right. Thanks, math.
You're welcome.
I don't know. Me no do math or numbers or things like that.
The Hobbit
was 48. And felt like someone sticking a fork into my eyes. So we had to see the horror of 120 frames per second.
Because there was literally only one week to see it. It was, starting this past Friday, if you wanted to see this movie in L.A., you were going to see it
at the Cinerama Dome.
Flat.
Before this Friday, you had to see it at the Cinerama Dome or nowhere.
Right.
In Los Angeles. If you wanted that experience.
Yeah.
We wanted that experience.
Yes. Because if this is what Ang Lee wanted us to see, then we needed to judge it on that level.
Okay. So we do. We go to the Cinerama Dome. Was it Wednesday morning or Thursday morning?
Wednesday.
For the 9 a.m. show.
Yes.
Now, because we live in Los Angeles, the average movie theater ticket is somewhere between $12 and $16.
Yeah.
Give or take some bargain matinees or some
or some large format
chain theaters somewhere where you might be able to get into something cheaper.
Right.
But it's fairly pricey to go see a movie here. $12 to $16. Night times at the Arclight is now like $17.
Yeah. And if you went to like an IMAX theater, that would be even more.
Well, this, because it was 3D and 4K and 120 frames per second, the tickets were, don't laugh, listeners, $21 each.
And this is not like the schmancy movie theater where you take your shoes off and put your feet up and there's a waitress.
There's a recliner and someone taking your order for mozzarella sticks.
Yeah, no. This is just the Cinerama Dome.
$21.
Yeah. At 9 a.m.
We go in. And the guy tearing the tickets is talking up the screen. It's so crystal clear, you're not going to believe it.
Well,
he was right.
Truer words were never spoken.
I lasted 55 minutes.
You did. I stuck it out for the whole thing.
You did. Why don't you tell people what it's about, and then we'll go back to talking about this hell.
So it's based on a novel. Billy Lynn is a young Texan who joined the army.
Like 19. Yeah.
Joined the army after getting into a bit of a scrape with his sister's ex-fiance, and the judge basically gave him the option of serving time or serving in the armed forces. And it's 2004, so he joins the army, which means he gets shipped off to Iraq. Is it Iraq or Afghanistan, or do they say?
You know what? I don't remember. Probably Iraq.
He gets shipped off to Iraq.
Yeah.
As it turns out, he commits an act of heroism that happens to be caught on camera. Because it's 2004, and because the war is going badly, and the public is losing interest in it, he becomes the subject of this big propaganda tour. They send him and his Bravo company around the country to make personal appearances and press the flesh. This tour is culminating in Dallas. So over the course of a day, we see Billy Lynn, played by newcomer Joe Alwyn, and his staff sergeant, played by Garrett Hedlund, and his fellow soldiers, heading to this football game where they will be featured in a halftime show with Destiny's Child. And over the course of that day, we meet people who are involved with them now. Chris Tucker is the guy who's trying to sell their story to the movies. Steve Martin is the team owner who kind of wants to exploit them. There's a cheerleader that Billy kind of falls in love with. And then there's all these flashbacks to Billy's family, including his sister, played by Kristen Stewart, who is trying to see if she can get him out of the army. Flashbacks to what happened that day on the battlefield and his other sergeant who he tried to save, played by Vin Diesel. And it's in the 120 frames a second, it is bizarrely sharp.
Well,
I mean, there's like early on, like
you're underselling
right at
the experience.
Right after the credits end, they like fall out in front of this hotel in Dallas, and the camera, like Garrett Hedlund, is like front and center, like big close up on his face. There's a lot of big close ups on faces over the course of this movie.
Yeah, which is not, you don't want that.
And they are just
turns out you don't want that.
You don't want that. But yeah. It's unsettling because just you immediately like, oh my God, it's right there. I remember the first time I saw an HD TV and they were showing some Home and Garden show, and it was just like, oh, this is like looking through a window. Like, it's right there. Like, I can see every blade of grass. This is right there. And it's that same thing where it feels like it's right there on the other side of the screen, like they're right in front of you.
Yes.
And that's jarring for a movie audience, I think.
Everything on screen is jarring. Now, I walked out after 55 minutes and I did not go back in.
Now, did you see the halftime show itself?
No. That's the part where
if, you know, a lot of times you get these movies like The Dark Knight or wherever, where you find out there's like three sequences that were shot with IMAX cameras. So if you see the movie in IMAX, suddenly it, you know, it expands to fill the screen or whatever. And it's like this big moment. It's a standout, and then back to the movie for a while. And then another big thing. If just the halftime stuff and maybe the wartime flashbacks had been in the 120 frames per second and the rest of it had been in standard 24, that would have been super effective. It would have put us inside Billy's head. It would have made those memories like so kind of tangibly real as a way to express like what PTSD must feel like in a cinematic language. But to do the whole movie that way, you're just standing it at a distance going, well, look at that.
What I am saying right now on this podcast cannot be called a review because I did not stay for the entire film.
Okay.
I don't want anybody being like, you can't review this movie or talk about it because you walked out. There were reasons I walked out, and I'm fixing to tell you what they are. But I did read Amy Nicholson's review.
Yes.
And she expressed my thoughts completely. She said she wanted to crawl out of her own skin, and that is exactly how I felt, and that is why I escaped. Here's what it turns out that I do not want. I do not want to notice every single thing. I want you, the filmmaker, to show me the thing that's most important.
It's like,
I want you to show me the character you want me to look at. And if you've got 19 other people standing behind them who are day players, extras from central casting, who are exaggerating their facial expressions and having absolutely clearly fake conversations so that they look like people milling around in the background, people who should actually be in soft focus so they don't really notice them at all.
Right.
I don't want to be distracted and pulled into every single one of their facial expressions. I don't want that. I don't want to feel like the man standing in front of me, Steve Martin, we'll call him. I don't want it to look like a disembodied Wizard of Oz head.
Yes!
Hectoring, totally. Hectoring me about something. I don't want to be able to see Steve Martin's makeup. I don't want to see everyone's pores. I don't want to see these things. I like my film reality to be unreal.
There is an uncanny valley thing going on here.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it so masterfully captures what reality looks like that you look at it like it's reality and like it's a movie, and those are two different
things. In a film that is visually, like, the only word to use right here is normal. In a film that is visually normal, the heightened quality of performance doesn't feel so performative.
Yeah, artificial.
But when you can see every single thing and it's drawing attention to that fact, a performance feels like a performance. And the only person who survives this film, performance-wise, is Kristen Stewart. And I had a couple days to figure out why. She lives in a land of understatement.
Mm.
And her style of acting is always kind of subdued. And it didn't serve her well in the early Twilight films. But she's really found the place where she belongs now. Mm-hmm. In films like Clouds of Sils Maria, for which she won a César Award.
Yes.
Okay? And Certain Women, which is a beautiful film. And it suits her perfectly. She is one of our more interesting young actors.
Yes.
Because she has learned who she is and where she belongs. And in this film, she's the only person who is giving a performance that is low-key enough to survive the freak show of the formatting.
I was thinking about, like...
He said, after watching 55 minutes of the film, going out into the lobby and talking to the same... concession guy about the picture, who then told me, oh yeah, people walk out all the time. Especially
like
during
every
the,
show, you said, right?
Especially during the strobe sequence in the halftime show, yeah. Apparently. Or the war. I didn't stay for that part, so I don't know what he was talking
there's
about.
There's like smoke bombs going off and yeah. Like all these lights and stuff.
And then I went to Amoeba Records and just hung out for the next 30 minutes waiting for you to get out of the movie.
I was thinking about like how to describe this to people, and it sort of looks like this. If you've seen like an action movie where, you know, it's been filmed and edited and processed and it looks great and there's explosions and you take it all as part of that sort of cinematic reality.
Yeah.
And then you see like the making of B-roll on E or something or on the DVD.
And it looks like a soap opera from 1987.
And it's shot at this other angle and you're conscious of that they're in a room and they're on a set and like the actual things that are exploding in that moment are just little firecrackers.
Right.
That's what watching Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk in 120 frames per second is like. It's like watching the B-roll.
Yeah.
It's like watching a rehearsal. It doesn't.
I also realize that we're talking about a thing that no one gets to see.
Exactly. But it's a thing that existed.
But it is a thing that some people did get to see.
And we've not heard the last of this technology.
For a short time. I don't know how they're going to use it or what they're going to do with it, but it made everything look like what happens when you forget to turn your
TV...
The
smoothing off.
You forget to turn your TV off of the sports setting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Believe me, this will come back. People will play... James Cameron, I bet you, is probably going to use this stuff for like the Avatar sequels. So just gird yourself, America.
I will not. I will not. I will not.
But yeah, so, you know, here's the thing, though. Even if you...
I will resist it like Donald Trump.
We did not see this movie both ways, which some critics have done.
Sorry. I will resist it in the manner in which I intend to resist Donald Trump for the next 4 years.
There we go.
That's what I meant to say.
Yes. Yeah. We did not see it both ways, but I think that just based on this viewing, I can safely say that the satire is a little either on the nose or at times kind of nebulous. I mean, the movie does make it a point to sort of call out the people who are super loud about our troops, you know, when at the same time they are.
No, I my understanding is that this film does have a point about patriotism and a satirical look at the way we deal with the concept of the troops.
Right. Yes. And how we exploit them and what we really want.
I cannot
from them.
Speak to that because I walked.
You didn't
out.
See the movie. You know the whole thing. I know. I think the movie makes some good jabs in that direction, and certainly I think there's going to be a lot of people who, you know, who see the ads for this movie and see like a soldier and fireworks and think, oh great, you know, and they're going to be kind of surprised by what they get. And I'm glad that this movie exists to make those points, but I don't think it always makes them as sharply as it could have. And I think Joe Alwyn is kind of out of his depth here.
He's brand new, right? It's like his first film
or
something?
I think so, yeah. He's thrown into a lot of stuff here, and I don't think he can really put this thing over. I would say if there's one other performance in here that works besides Kristen Stewart's, it's Garrett Hedlund. And I
Not
think,
for me.
but I think he's doing,
I had to run away from him.
I think he's doing the opposite thing. I think he's playing it a little big. And that also works in a way because at least it's at least cinematic, I guess. I don't
Yeah.
know. It's hard to say. But I didn't mind him so much. But everybody else, Steve Martin especially, oof.
I have a favor to ask you. Can
What's
we
that?
save best worst thing
Are you gonna watch it?
so that I can watch it from start to finish?
Okay.
Because I only saw like chunks of it while you were watching it on the
Okay.
TV,
Well, it's
and it's only open on two screens
it
at
opened
the
in New
moment.
York this weekend.
And
It's opening in LA
so,
next
like when
weekend.
we do the stopgap episode,
Okay.
let me get to
All
that.
right. So we'll
And
talk
so
about.
why don't you just talk about Hunter Gatherer, which I have no intention of seeing.
Sure. Well, let me explain first. Best worst thing that ever could have happened is a documentary about the beloved Sondheim flop, Merrily We Roll Along, and the people who made it happen, directed by one of the original cast members. And spoiler, it's great. We'll talk about it next time, though. Okay, so Hunter Gatherer is one of the films that we awarded a special jury prize to at South by Southwest this year. The jury that I was on with Lindsay Baer and Richard Brody, we honored Best Actor Andre Royo, who is you may know him from The Wire. He's currently on Empire. He's an actor I think has made some really interesting choices, and this is one of his best performances. He plays a guy who's recently got out of prison. He's trying to get his old girlfriend back and winds up getting into this bizarre scheme to unload people's old refrigerators. It's a very eccentric film that's mainly anchored, I think, by the really strong performances in it. But it's also this kind of bittersweet movie about people trying to just kind of get on with their lives and move on with things. It's a little indie and it's. I don't want to oversell it, but it's definitely worth seeing for Andre's performance, and it's just an odd little movie that goes in some unexpected directions, I think. You should catch up on it one of these days.
Maybe. I might.
But yeah, if it's opening near you or if it's streaming soon,
Who's paying me for that?
the members of Linoleum Knife, our Patreon club.
I suppose you're right. Let's do a 30-second commercial for us. Would you like to subscribe to LKTV, a podcast of the television
Sure, you would.
that we host? Would you like to get other things in your life that are in addition to LKTV, a podcast of the television that we host? I think you would. Therefore, you should go to Patreon, patreon.com/linoleumknife, and subscribe.
Yeah, join our
Four
club.
Bucks a month, you get to join our club. If you join at a higher level, you get more things. There's a whole list. There's a video. You go there, you look at it, you decide, what's right for me? How rich am I?
What fits my lifestyle?
Yeah. But yeah, $4 a month. Endless delights
Indeed.
brought to you by us.
Mm
That's all.
We
Was
keep
that even 30 seconds?
A little more,
I
but
don't
it
want to bore
was.
people with too much
Yeah,
promotion.
I don't. I think that was just enough.
Okay. You got a DVD recommendation?
Yeah, come back to me. Okay, fine.
Okay,
No,
well,
all right, yeah.
it's
I had one and then I forgot what it was. I now remember. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
Why that one?
Because it's the Christmassy one.
Yes. It has a Christmas sequence. It is the most contested title in your book, in this house,
I don't
anyway.
know.
In
Maybe
your
by
book,
you.
Have yourself a movie Little Christmas, of which we are sold out, sorry. That is the one movie that I disagree with you on. You shouldn't have it in your book.
There is a lengthy Yule Ball
There sure
sequence.
is, but it's not the point of the film, and therefore it shouldn't be in the
Fine,
movie.
but you know what? That the Yule Ball sequence is
The
longer.
Christmas
It's.
sequence in Female Trouble
I was just going to say, it's longer than the
is
Cha-Cha heel
less
scene in
it,
Female
it is
Trouble.
longer, and yet also less meaningful. So Female Trouble, sure, put it in there because it has such
Resonance.
it has such a resonant and iconic, I hate to use that word, but iconic Christmas scene that when you think of Christmas in movies, you think of divine throwing those shoes at her parents and like shoving the tree. And like, you think of that. Ain't nobody thinking about Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire when they think, ah, my favorite Christmas films.
Well,
it's just not happening.
Look, I like to acknowledge the fact that Christmas has very strong pagan connections. The fact that they have a Yule Ball at Hogwarts.
All right, fine.
That's my movie. What's yours?
Mine is the latest documentary from Barbara Kopple, legendary documentary filmmaker Barbara Kopple.
Yes.
The film is called Hot Type.
Mm-hmm.
It is available on DVD now. It is the 150-year saga history of The Nation magazine. Stalwart, lefty, liberal newspaper, The Nation.
Yes.
To which you and I need to resubscribe.
We should.
We used to subscribe to The Nation, but it became kind of like our New Yorker.
That it's stacked up.
It's stacked up, and we're like, oh, we have to get to this lengthy article about the coming water crisis. and then it felt like a weight on my shoulders, but now it feels urgent again.
And they need to be supported.
And they need to be supported because the press is in danger. We're all in danger, honestly. Yes. The whole country. And
So shoe this, leather and non-clickbaity journalism needs your help.
This documentary is an inspiring film about an inspirational new magazine.
There you go.
That has done great work for 150 years. Watch it. It's called Hot Type.
Alrighty then. Do we have letters?
I got three letters.
Okay.
They date from September.
Where the stopgap episode will catch us up.
Hey, handsome men.
Ooh, Mr. Firefly.
That's us. I mean, seriously. Look at how we're a basket of adorables. Look at how cute we are.
I have a good face for podcast.
I have a good face for character acting. Oh, this is from Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Tony is my opera mentor.
Ah,
well, okay. One of them.
Hey, Anne Majette is your...
Anne's my opera goddess.
Okay.
She brought me to my very first one back in the day when I was a young man. This past Friday, I watched Other People after hearing your review. And I can honestly say that I hate and love you for recommending that film. I love you for it because I genuinely loved the movie. The performances were uniformly perfect, particularly Molly Shannon, who better win an Oscar for this. I hated you because I ugly cried twice during the film, something that rarely happens. I ended up calling my mom afterwards and basically told her that she was never allowed to die. Well, I'm sorry, Tony, but guess what? That's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It happened. How old were you? You were 18.
Yes.
That is unimaginable to me. I mean, I've known you for almost 22 years, and it's still, I find that life circumstance of yours to be something unimaginable.
Well, it sucked.
Yeah. Yeah. Your mom died when you were 18.
Yes.
Mine died 4 years ago, and I was 40 whatever when it happened. That was not good.
Look, 18 is more than a lot of other people get.
Yeah.
So,
you know. I know. But what I'm telling all y'all listening, if you still have your mom with you and you can stand her and she's not a sociopath.
Total battle axe.
And a sociopath that you have no contact with for very good reasons, go be nice to your mommy because it's going to happen.
Yes.
Yeah. I will continue reading the letter now. my only gripe with the film was that it gave the impression that Sacramento doesn't have a vibrant gay scene.
Ah.
We have more than one gay bar. We have five. Ranging from a leather dive bar to a multi-story dance club. Sacramento isn't Los Angeles, but it's not quite the desert of gayness the film makes it out to be. Hugs to both of you. And please, more talk about Dave baking. Well, you just got a
bean story.
A little talk about lima beans, which is kind of the same thing.
And we have the Christmas tree pound cake mold. So it's on.
Did we talk about that before?
I don't know if we've discussed it on the show. We've talked about it on Facebook and stuff. But we got the Williams-Sonoma.
For free.
Two halves of
a... We got this for free.
Well, because we had a leftover gift card.
Yeah.
We got the two halves of a Christmas tree pound cake mold.
Yeah, yeah. And it's detailed.
Very.
Like, it's got little ornaments and candles and things. Like, I don't know how it's going to all work out, but...
Like so many nooks and crannies. I can't imagine how these things pop out evenly, and I can't imagine how you clean this thing afterwards. But, you know,
I'm fixing to find out.
We will learn.
Yeah. Thank you, Tony.
Yes.
This is from Harold. Hey, guys. At least once, and usually more times during each of your podcasts, I feel the need to jot down some cool reference just so I don't forget. It is the highlight of my week, like having a conversation with friends while I work. Thank you, Harold. We are your friends.
We are.
My new favorite movie is Todd Haynes' Valley of the Dolls. I know it does not now and probably will never exist, but I cannot stop loving this idea. Idina Menzel as Helen Lawson, please.
It would be great.
Successful movies from TV shows. How about Brain Candy? Or Adam's Family?
I don't think Brain Candy works all the way.
I didn't really dig Brain Candy.
There are funny
all
things in it. Yeah. Adam's Family is okay. I like
Adam's Family
Values
yes.
better.
Yes.
And a great Thanksgiving movie while we're on the subject.
Movie pairing ideas. The Women and Lilies.
No.
They're single gender casts.
Right. Huh.
Bride of Frankenstein and... Gods and Monsters, of course.
Yeah, yes. Okay.
The Prince and the Showgirl and My Week with Marilyn. Boy, howdy, did I dislike My Week with Marilyn.
Yeah,
I did not enjoy that one at all.
And frankly, Prince and the Showgirl isn't that great either.
Oh, come on.
It's not. I mean, look, Marilyn's always fun to watch.
She's always fun to watch.
But you would think that a movie with her and Laurence Olivier would have some real zip to it, and
obviously,
it doesn't.
If you're going to watch any one Marilyn Monroe movie, it must be... I know you're going to say something like It Hot, but in reality, it's
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, sure,
which
yeah.
I cannot see enough times. And we have a Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode.
True.
Devoted to it, which costs $1.99 via PayPal to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and you should get it.
Yes.
If you're not already an LK a club member, which means at some level you automatically get it.
You do. So.
And then Valley of the Dolls and, ooh, isn't she great? No.
No. Oh, God, no. You're better off watching the TV movie about Jacqueline Suzanne with Michelle Lee in it than you are watching
which
Isn't She Great.
Kind of a gas.
Yeah, it has its moments. Yeah. Isn't She Great is abominable.
I have given up on favorite movie lists. My tastes are far too fluid. But when I see a movie that I enjoy, I always wonder what you guys would think. So here goes. Ben-Hur, the silent version.
Oh,
it's
good.
It's really good.
We just yeah. watched it again yeah. for the remake.
Imitation of Life.
I assume you mean the Lana Turner version?
The Claudette Colbert.
Oh, the Claudette Colbert. Oh, okay, yeah. Ben. You know, I've never seen it.
Neither have I.
I've only seen the
yeah,
the,
sorry,
the
that's,
remake.
That's, we got to do it.
We do.
Yeah. Lady for a Day.
Frank Capra.
Frank Capra, okay.
I have also not seen that one. I have seen Pocketful of Miracles, which is the remake of that.
My Favorite Wife, which I dig.
I like My Favorite Wife. Yeah. It is not nearly as good as The Awful Truth.
Cary Grant and Randolph Scott have great chemistry.
Well, yeah.
You better have great chemistry if you're getting it in.
Yeah. It's okay. I like it. I love the scene where he's like sticking the pen in the fan to try and convince Gail Patrick that he's at the airport, and then he comes out of the phone booth and she's right there. Like, that's a great moment.
He lists a few more that I haven't seen. The Model and the Marriage Broker. Have you seen that?
I have not.
To Be or Not to Be. Which one?
I would imagine he means the Lubitsch version, okay. Which is great. The Mel Brooks one is okay.
There's No Business Like Show Business.
Not my favorite. it's very Ethel Merman.
Time Bandits.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
Dig Love that. It. Yeah. Edge of 17. How do you feel about that film, Edge of 17?
The gay one.
I assume that's what
yes,
we're talking
we're
about.
Yes, we're not talking about the new one.
Yeah.
I like Edge of 17.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's well done. It's interesting that the... It was very autobiographical for the screenwriter, and he was going to direct it until the last minute, and then handed the reins over to David Morton, who was the producer, and that wound up being his directorial debut. And then David went on to make Testosterone with our friend Dennis.
Right.
And then the writer, whose name is flying out of my mind, he went on to do the another gay movie and another movie about another Stevie Nicks related thing.
Sarah Rue, and I forget the title. And
No, I like Edge of 17 a lot.
Morris.
Oh, well.
Well, yeah.
Which is, that's going to be next year's reissue. You know, remember this year there was the Howard Zend reissue?
That really good Howard Zend reissue. Yeah,
that Cohen Media Group did. Next year they're doing Morris.
Oh, sweet.
That's going to be great.
He says, and finally, vintage cake stands. I have a small collection, and I am obsessed with one that Martha Stewart has that I cannot find. She used it in an episode of her show Martha Bakes. See attached. It's a beauty. It's like white, sort of like milk glass, and it's real nice. No, I'm down. I keep looking for the one I want. I have not found it yet, but I'm.
If they're good enough for Mary Berry.
I'm not going to give up until I find exactly the one I want.
There was a funny bit on a recent My Brother and Me where somebody had asked a question about making a novelty penis cake for a bachelorette party.
Yeah.
And they were imagining like Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood giving notes.
Sure. This is from Shelby.
Mm-hmm.
Hey there. I've been listening now for over a year. And your podcast has quickly become my go-to.
Oh, well.
You both have introduced me to films I wouldn't have experienced otherwise, and most of all, have got me driving all over the Southern California area just to see a movie.
Hmm.
The Wailing and Mountains May Depart come to mind.
Oh, okay.
Oh, God. Have you still not yet watched The Wailing?
It's in the stack.
Dude, before you vote for LAFCA,
okay.
I'm telling you, one of the craziest films of the year.
You realize that no one else in the room is going to have seen it or care. Or some of them will have seen it, but no one, it's not going to...
Like my friend Big Sean says, I don't give up.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch it eventually. I just don't know if I'll watch it before we vote, but whatever.
I also want to say thanks to Alonzo for screening I Am Love on the big screen at school. Oh, this is
one of my Chapman students.
One of your
okay.
former students.
Funny. Shelby, right, yes.
I sat in the third row and had a borderline religious experience, thanks.
Excellent.
You know, this, I feel, is a nice sort of validation, given the fact that you showed me your...
syllabus?
Not the syllabus, but your...
Evaluations.
Your student evaluations. And some of the just straight up... And not even constructively critical, but just like mean. like as though you were a person on Twitter that they didn't know. It blew my mind, honestly, hearing you read out loud what amounts to Jimmy Kimmel mean tweets about you.
Whatever.
Well, you know what? It's one thing when someone says
I can reach one student.
When someone says something mean about
me, I am love.
Now listen, when someone says something mean about me,
uh-huh.
I can just be like,
"Yeah,
I am not currently making the motion of my
flicking off the shoulder,
flicking stuff off my shoulder." But when people say stuff about you,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, "Who wants to fight? Try me. I got some steel-toed boots on. We can go." It'll be American History X.
See, look, I have a good review. That's all that I care
about. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Shelby. Yes. There's more.
Oh, okay.
Anyhow, I've been trying to think of a list to send for a few months and couldn't come up with a proper top 10 that satisfied me. So here's a list of my 10 favorite films of the last 10 years in no particular order. The Overnighters, which you have not seen.
I have the documentary.
So good.
I need to see that.
Yeah. And a documentary that's good for this moment in history, I must tell you.
Newly relevant?
Yeah, freshly relevant, and it will stay that way.
Right.
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh, love it.
This Must Be the Place. Yeah, not for me.
I love The Great Beauty, but...
It opened up the world of David Byrne's music to me, so the two are forever connected, and come on, that Buffalo scene is amazing.
Look, if you want the movies about David Byrne's music, go watch Stop Making Sense and True Stories.
I Am Love.
Yep.
Nothing Bad Can Happen.
I don't know that one.
Do I not know that one?
Nothing Bad Can Happen.
I gotta look that one up after the show.
Okay.
Take Shelter.
Mm, yes. Michael Shannon.
Boy and the World.
An animated film that I need to see. That was, I remember at the end of the year, in the last couple of years, that was one that people were talking about.
Yeah. Human Capital, which I have not yet seen.
Don't know that one.
Lake Cowboys, which I have also not yet seen. It came and gone like in a week at one of the Lemleys.
Robert reviewed it for The Wrap, and he was kind of on it, and I didn't get around to it.
And Inside Llewyn Davis, which I really I really love Inside Llewyn Davis. Okay. So we are done.
Well, what percent knife was that?
100. Well, no, this must be the place. 90. 90. Okay. 90%. You're 90% knife, Shelby.
Yeah. Hurrah.
The here's the thing. Do you want a t-shirt? Do you want to buy a t-shirt? It says linoleum knife on it. Black shirt, white letters, linoleum knife.
And you don't have to join our club.
You don't even
to
have
get
to join
one.
You don't even have to join Patreon to get this. It's $22. PayPal linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Email us first and ask us about sizes.
And,
but we have all kinds, including the ladies.
And if you are outside the U.S., let us know that too, because it'll cost you a little more for postage.
Yep. The end, we're done.
Okay, great. Well,
time
as always,
them lima beans.
Thank you for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. It's so great. Somebody compared it to...
the music from
The Greasy Strangler.
The Greasy Strangler, which
is certainly catchy.
I like it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Bibbs and Whitney, of course, doing the B-Movies podcast and Cancel Too Soon. Our dear friend Dennis Hensley is about to start Patreoning himself for his great podcast, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley.
Right.
Once that goes up, I'll put a link on the Facebook page, but go throw him some love if you can spare it. Check out the Schmoes Know.
Look, if you have to drop down from $7 to $4 a month let's say you're a Patreon person with us at maybe the $7 level. If you want to drop down to $4 and throw the rest to Dennis Hensley, we would appreciate it.
We would totally understand that. Yeah. But if you could, support us both, that's great too.
Whatever. That's not the point.
I'm just throwing all the options on the table. Listen to the
money bags.
The Schmoes Know, the Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, the Joe Al Ryan thing, the Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Film Spotting, SVU, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. Leave us a review. It helps.
We got a 1-star.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Did we ever?
We got a 1-star.
Did we not read that yet?
No, it doesn't matter. Oh. But he called us smarmy, which
is not even quite what he means.
I don't think whoever wrote it knows the definition of smarmy because. No. It means insincere, like
there's a lot of things you can call us, but I don't.
We're the most sincere pumpkin patch in this.
That's right.
Apartment.
Yes, no question.
So,
anyway, but leave us a nice review. That'd be great. It does help people find the show.
5 stars only.
Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. You can stream the show and leave us positive feedback at Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Google Play if you're an Android user. Podbean, Castbox, and Satchel.
And Florp Buzz.
Florp Buzz is all happening right now. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments or top 10 lists. We are going to get caught up on letters this week. And, of course, join our club at Patreon.
Actually, finally caught up on the letter.
Really, for sure.
Yeah.
And then, of course, join our club, patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you are in the Los Angeles area on Tuesday, December 6th, I will be hosting with Frank DeCaro the 3rd annual Movie Little Christmas in Tinseltown at the council chambers of the West Hollywood Public Library. You can get tickets at outfest.org.
And what day is it?
Tuesday, December 6th.
I'll be at the merch table.
Yes, and it's going to be a stone-cold gas. So kick off your holidays with that. And we'll be back next time. Thanks for joining us.
Goodbye.